You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the future of two paper mills in central Wisconsin is still in limbo after Governor Evers vetoed a bill that would have helped finance their purchase by a timber industry group. We'll find out more about the story and talk to one of the authors of that bill. First, with vaccines now widely available, a lot of Wisconsinites have been able to make summer plans more like the ones they did before the pandemic, seeing family, joining sports leagues, holding birthday parties. But for families with members who can't get the vaccine, it can be tricky to understand what's safe and to navigate spaces where so many people have let their guards down. Madeline Fox has more on families with a mixed vaccination status.
A drawer in the laundry room of the Albert Home in Mequon is stuffed with masks in different sizes, colors, and patterns.
So we kind of mix, like, as long as they're clean, like, I don't mind whatever kid wants to wear, whatever.
The family of six still get a lot of use out of it, with three of their four kids too young to get vaccinated. They've been able to do more than they could last summer. Their daughter Kieran is playing softball again, just with masks. They get to see family that lives nearby.
My mom just had a birthday a couple days ago, and so when we got together, the adults usually don't mask now, but the kids that are unvaccinated still do, like when we're inside to have dessert, that kind of thing.
On a Friday morning, they headed for their local library in Mequon. The three youngest kept their masks on, and they headed to the self-checkout with a whopping 33 books. The Alberts have been able to keep relatively busy with the library, the playground next door, and sports teams, but have kept their pre-vaccination precautions in place, especially for kids Kieran, Liam, and Bryn. Generally, the guidance from state and federal health agencies is the same for unvaccinated kids as it was for everyone a few months ago, says Medical College of Wisconsin epidemiologist Laura Cassidy.
We do know that wearing a mask protects them. We know distancing, we know hygiene, we know all this, and, you know, the poor kids are going to have to do that a little longer than some of us, but we should all, you know, support the children in that.
Still, with disease levels down substantially, some summer school programs and camps are dropping mask requirements and distancing guidelines, even for kids who can't get the shots. That's left it up to individual families to weigh the risks of certain activities and inquire whether any COVID precautions are still in place.
You have to balance the risk with the benefit of the social interactions and of the sports and of the being outside. And, you know, what is the child's individual health status?
Cassidy says with family members who aren't vaccinated or for whom the vaccine might not offer as much protection because of underlying conditions, it's probably still safer to drive to a vacation spot than fly, for example. That's how the Alberts are navigating vacation. Local parties with family are okay, but seeing family in other parts of the world will have to wait, says mom Kathleen and Landon, who's 13.
That is one thing we haven't been able to do.
Like
so.
England or India to see my cousins and grandparents.
So my husband's parents still live in India and some extended family, and we've been trying to go every couple years, and it's been 2 years this summer.
How families are feeling now about the risks from COVID varies depending on how they've experienced the pandemic so far. Some had less access to health care, underlying conditions, and fewer resources. COVID fell heaviest on low-income families and families of color, who disproportionately lost loved ones, but also jobs and homes.
When we use the word normal, it is invalidating, because it means that we can return to what was.
That's Sinesha Dale, a professor of psychology at the University of Miami. She studied and worked with families affected by the trauma of another deadly disease, HIV.
For people who have experienced a lot of trauma and a lot of losses, there is no return to what was. It's trying to forge ahead.
As COVID restrictions lift, she says ideally vaccinated people would also try to make things easier for people not yet protected by vaccination.
We have to ask ourselves, like, what is it that I want to get out of this activity? And then think about, well, are there adjustments that could be made where I would still get the feeling and fulfillment that I would want from it, but I would minimize the potential risk to myself or other people that I love?
Kids under 12 are expected to get approval for the vaccine sometime next fall. At least until then, many families will continue weighing risks while they watch much of the country happily set aside the precautions of the last year and a half. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now we'll hear more from the Wisconsin epidemiologist in that story and look at the ways we can protect non-vaccinated friends, family members, and coworkers. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have kids under the age of 12? How are you deciding which activities are safe and okay? What precautions are you still taking? What have you cast aside? What has you confused? And are you or is someone in your family someone with a compromised immune system where either you can't get the vaccine or you can, but you're not sure how well it's going to work? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Laura Cassidy is a professor and director of epidemiology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Let's start with what I imagine is a really common situation. Vaccinated parents, but their kids under 12 can't get vaccinated yet. And parents might be thinking on the one hand, well, I know COVID isn't as bad for kids, but on the other hand, that doesn't mean it's, you know, harmless. On the other hand, you know, you start to run out of hands pretty quick. How do you advise a family to start weighing those risks versus the benefits of doing stuff?
Right. And this is very individual from family to family, depending on how many of your family members are vaccinated and how many children you have who are unvaccinated or not eligible to get it. And I think the thing to keep in mind is anyone who is not vaccinated is at risk of getting COVID-19 and could be at risk of getting seriously ill. So it is important to take this seriously. And the more adults that are vaccinated and people who can be vaccinated and are immune, that is the best way to protect our children. But all throughout the pandemic, we've talked about layers of protection. And vaccination is the toughest layer. But on top of that, we can still wear masks, social distance, wash our hands. Being outside is better. So I would just think about the benefits of the things you want to do and how to mitigate the risks in each situation.
And as we heard in that piece there, we don't have vaccines approved for kids 12 and under yet, or under 12. Do you have a sense of the timeline to where that might be a reality?
Well, they are conducting clinical trials now with children under 12 years of age. And so the data indicates that it would likely be sometime this fall where there could be an emergency use authorization. It would likely maybe go down to 6 years first and then younger children, but that depends on the data.
How about within a household where you've got, again, some people vaccinated, some not, either because they're young or for whatever reason? Are there ways we should be thinking about, you know, living together in the same place and ways to protect the unvaccinated in our own homes?
Yes. Well, if the majority or all of the people who are of age and able to get vaccinated are, that's the best way to protect them. You can interact with other families who have high vaccination rates, preferably outside. And if they're practicing safety precautions as you, you know, the bubble is good. Outdoor activities are good. Think about the rate in your community. Each individual community is different. Think about, do you have a high vaccination rate in your community, or do you have a low vaccination rate and a higher spread of disease? Then your children are more at risk and you want to be more careful.
Does that make it kind of hard for people to evaluate? Because there's a lot of variables there. It's not simple yes, no type questions, right?
Right. It is very difficult. And I imagine it's very stressful for parents as well and children. And I think, you know, throughout this, probably one of the keys is some consistency. And we've had a lot of changing messages, new data, new information, and we're learning as we go. And I think with children, you know, being consistent is important. And we've been stressing the mask wearing and distancing for their safety throughout the pandemic. So I think continuing that in the best way we can also offers some stability for the children.
Now, I've been focusing on children who can't get vaccinated yet. There's also concerns about people who are immunocompromised. In a lot of cases, as I understand it, please correct me if I'm wrong, their bodies, even when they get the vaccine, might not have that immune response that most of us would get with the vaccine. How worried are you about people in that situation?
Yeah, well, I would be very protective of people in that situation. And another thing to consider is if you have people in that situation and you also have children in the household who can't get vaccinated, then you want to be even more cautious because we want to protect everybody the best we can. I do know in Israel, they're going to start offering a third booster to people who are immunocompromised to help boost their immunity a little more. And perhaps they may be considering that here as well.
We're talking to Laura Cassidy, professor and director of epidemiology at the Medical College of Wisconsin, talking about how to stay safe if some members of your household are vaccinated and others are not. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you wrestling with some of these questions right now, this summer maybe, or wondering what you're going to do in the fall, and especially the winter when it's harder to go outside? What kind of activities are on your approved list with kids? What precautions are you taking? What questions do you have for our guest epidemiologist? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk now with Medical College of Wisconsin epidemiologist Laura Cassidy about mixed vaccination status households, places where maybe parents are vaccinated, kids under 12 aren't and can't be yet, how to stay safe. You can join in with your questions or your experiences, what you are doing to stay safe, what kind of precautions you're still taking, what has the thumbs up for the kids. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We got a message from a Susie in southwestern Wisconsin who wonders if people who are vaccinated can still carry COVID, and if so, why are we opening things up without making sure we're still masking? So the main part of that, Laura, how likely are we to spread COVID if we are already vaccinated?
Well, we do know that people who are vaccinated the vaccines are very effective at preventing serious illness and hospitalizations, especially with the Delta variant. There's been reports of people who have a mild case of COVID, and the symptoms can be quite different. Well, not quite different, but a little different in that it is a sore throat, sneezing, runny nose are more prevalent than some of the other traditional ones we've been used to. I think we're still evaluating the data on how much it can be transferred to other people. But the data suggests that it is effective in reducing transmission.
So for that parent then who, is vaccinated, has a kid at home, are there precautions they should be taking just when they're out in public to avoid even the slight risk of bringing COVID home to their unvaccinated kids?
Yeah, if they're concerned, then they should continue to wear a mask and watch the activities that they engage in and keep their distance.
Susie, thanks for that message. You can join in with your questions or comments, or love to hear your experiences and what you're doing in your family at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Laura, I know last summer COVID took a dive. It dipped a lot here in the U.S. and then came back in the fall and winter a lot as we, of course, went back inside in places like Wisconsin. And you just described a Delta variant with symptoms that sound a lot like cold and flu, and they're going to be hard to tell apart. How worried are you about what's going to happen here in the fall, especially as this Delta variant goes around and we have pockets of unvaccinated people?
Yeah, I think you can see right now what's going on in some of the states where they have the lowest rates of unvaccinated individuals, and they're seeing surges, because the Delta variant is so much more contagious and causes much more severe illness. And so in states like Missouri, their hospitals are filling up again because they have so many unvaccinated people. So the key really is the vaccine. That is our ticket out of this pandemic. And so entering the fall, the more people we can get vaccinated before fall, the better. Schools have been shown to be pretty safe, and if they have good ventilation and good practices, then we can be confident in sending our children back to school. But again, it is difficult sometimes to tease out if it's a mild case of COVID, distinguishing that from something else. So if you are unvaccinated, then you really need to wear masks and monitor yourself and get tested. You can't really have it both ways.
a lot of this, as you've mentioned, keeps coming back to getting people vaccinated early on. There's a supply issue. At the beginning, we didn't have enough vaccine to get to all the people who wanted it. Now we do, and it's demand, or in some cases, accessibility that's holding things up. Are there things you'd like to see focused on to try to boost those vaccination numbers even further?
Yeah, I think probably one of the most effective ways to decrease vaccine hesitancy and increase the confidence is by people having conversations. You know, everybody's heard from the experts, they've heard from the doctors, but, you know, peer-to-peer conversations about the fact that you are 100 times greater risk of getting severe COVID than you are of getting any kind of serious side effect from the vaccine. So the vaccines are available and they do work.
We are talking about COVID and vaccines and what to do in mixed vaccine status families with Laura Cassidy, professor and director of epidemiology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions or how you are handling these issues. Again, 800-642-1234. And Laura, it's the summertime. People are traveling again a lot, driving in some cases, flying in others. What kind of advice do you have for people as they consider travel plans with COVID precautions in mind?
Yeah, I know we're all anxious to get back out there and have fun. So look at where you're traveling to and where you're traveling through and check out if it's an area with high vaccination rates and low disease. So right now you would want to avoid those states that are seeing a surge. Anytime there's more unvaccinated people, the disease can spread and people who are unvaccinated can get sick. So that's the first thing. Look at that. Be diligent with hand washing. If you have children or family members who can't be vaccinated, have them wear a mask in public. Try to do outdoor activities, eat at outdoor restaurants, and just, you know, follow the guidelines that we've been following until we can get our children vaccinated.
Let's go to our callers now. Terry is with us in Madison. Terry, hi. Oh, Terry dropped out. Terry was wanting more clarity. Terry's wondering what you see as the most risky behaviors, Laura. What's at the top of your, yeah, maybe still don't do that list right now?
Well, I would say gathering with a group of people indoors who aren't vaccinated. To categorize any certain activity, you know, really depends on if you're in an area, again, with low vaccination rates and unmasked in a large crowd inside.
All right, Terry, I dropped off the line there, but I hope you heard that, and I hope that answers your question. So the Delta variant, Laura, is the big part of the story right now. What kind of things do we still need to learn about that and other variants? What are some of the big open questions in your mind?
Yeah, well, some of the big open questions are, what are the long-term consequences of getting ill with COVID-19, whether it's severe or mild cases of COVID-19, we really don't know what the long-term effects are. And you hear about the long haulers and people who are sick for a long time. Well, especially in children, you know, they're still developing. So if they get sick, we really don't know how this affects them long-term.
And what are you watching for globally right now? I know we're ahead of the game in some ways in the United States when it comes to vaccination efforts. What countries around the world do you have your eye on for what's coming next?
Yeah, well, of course, we're worried about India, South America, and Africa. I have friends in Africa that I work with, and they share information with me. And, you know, the rates in Africa are going up. The vaccination rates are low and their healthcare system can't handle it. And I have a friend who's a physician in Uganda, and she texted me last week that she lost her father and her uncle last week. Their hospitals are full. They don't have enough oxygen and they don't have enough vaccines.
Let's try going back to our callers. Jennifer is with us in Milwaukee. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. I have a question. If you have a household where all members of the household are vaccinated and one person tests positive for COVID, what are the guidelines in terms of quarantining for the vaccinated other people.
Got it. Jennifer, thanks for the call. Laura?
Well, if they're all vaccinated and one person tests positive, I'm assuming that person was not vaccinated. But if everybody else is vaccinated, they're saying if you're exposed to somebody, the CDC says now, if you're exposed to somebody and you've been vaccinated, that you do not need to quarantine. But the positive case would need to quarantine and isolate.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for that call. And Laura, I keep seeing numbers lately where, you know, hospitals report of our patients who have been hospitalized with COVID, 99 or 100% are unvaccinated. We see this at hospitals, state level, and more. Can you talk about the difference that vaccines are making and the risk of being unvaccinated when we see numbers like that?
Yeah, it's just so clear. So clear that these vaccines are effective and that they protect you. And the people who are getting very sick now, who are getting hospitalized and are losing their lives, are those who are not vaccinated. And we are also seeing more hospitalizations and severe disease in younger people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. So this is concerning.
We'll leave it there for now. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Laura Cassidy, professor and director of epidemiology at the Medical College of Wisconsin, talking about COVID vaccines, how mixed vaccination status households can stay safe, and more. Coming up, we'll hear about a bill that would have helped finance the purchase of two central Wisconsin paper mills, why Governor Evers chose to veto it, and what comes next for that idea. Remember, you can follow all of our conversations here on the Ideas Network in a whole bunch of different ways. On your radio, of course, you can listen online at WPR.org. And remember, you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. You can listen to the Ideas Network and those other things we do at Wisconsin Public Radio, if you like. Download the app onto your smartphone or tablet. You can find it wherever you get your apps or find out how over at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, 60 years ago, one little pill changed the lives of millions of American women, and we've been arguing about it ever since. To mark the 60th anniversary of the pill hitting the market, 1A takes a closer look at what happened then, what's going on now, and what's next for contraception in the United States. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, Manitowoc's Anshei Polzetic Synagogue closed its doors earlier this year. The congregation was more than 100 years old, but its rich history couldn't overcome the state's shifting demographics. As Megan Hart reports, that doesn't mean its story is over.
The congregation held its last service in March. The synagogue's president, Bill Schwartz, says it was just a matter of time. At 56, he was the youngest member. Even before the pandemic, it was rare to get 10 people, the quorum needed for public worship.
The writing was on the wall that we lost another member. Passed away, that already eliminates the odds that we will ever have a minion.
The shrinking congregation was mirrored in other changes in the community. With some manufacturers leaving the area, the city itself is getting smaller. And in small towns, the even smaller Jewish communities are among the first to feel the effects when this happens. Over the years, Schwartz saw downtown Manitowoc transform.
The downtown used to be thriving with businesses. You know, from Washington Street to 8th Street, there was always stores. And then it just fizzle out, it just dried up.
In her book, Jews in Wisconsin, author Sheila Terman-Cohen says small Jewish communities once thrived here, but a couple of factors combined to begin changing that in the second half of the 20th century. Shopping malls started popping up, hurting Jewish-owned stores, and by the 1960s, most young Jewish Wisconsinites were attending four-year colleges and weren't eager to return to small towns. Schwartz tried to keep the synagogue going by reaching out personally.
So, hey, you know, this is your heritage. You know, you've been bar mitzvah here. You've been, you know, you had, you know, weddings. You had everything in the synagogue.
But he says most young people just weren't interested. Thanks to guests, there were 18 people at the synagogue's final service. It was recorded by a local company called Vagabond Creative. The congregation started downsizing back in 2016 when it sold its building and moved its services into the neighboring First Presbyterian Church at the invitation of its pastor. Ultimately, the congregation decided the money spent to keep things running could be better spent elsewhere. Short says some will go to local charities. A trust in the synagogue's name will provide scholarships for students interested in Jewish studies.
And that keeps us living for quite a few years, you know, and that's what we want. We want to be remembered.
Its tours have all been donated, too. One is with a congregation in Africa, and its silver is at Jewish Museum Milwaukee. A plaque commemorating the synagogue now hangs on the chapel that served as its final home. Leaving this kind of mark doesn't happen overnight. Anshe Polozetic's synagogue served worshippers for more than a century, and planning for its closure took almost a decade. Leaders reached out to Noah Levine from the Jewish Community Legacy Project. The organization helps small congregations navigate change, which doesn't always mean closing. Some want to focus on sustainability.
How do we get more volunteers? How do we get our congregants to be more participatory? What do we do about leader succession?
The organization helped create regional cohorts of small synagogues in places like Mississippi, Ohio, and Pennsylvania to share ideas and develop collaborative programming. He says it's a model they might suggest in Wisconsin. Still, Levine says some longstanding congregations will reach the point where the heart-wrenching decision to close is the right one.
On the other hand, we will also say that we need to do a disciplined, rational plan, because at the end of the day, the decisions you make are going to really redound to the benefit of your own legacy.
While he says you can't change the realities of a region, the good done by Anshe Polozetic's synagogue will live on forever. Back in April, Short said he hoped to organize a carpool to services at Congregation Bethel in Sheboygan, where he says the synagogue is thriving. Services always have a minyan, so they can read from the Torah. Their collection now includes one donated from Anshe Polozetic's synagogue. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, Governor Evers vetoed a bill last week that would have used about $65 million in federal COVID-19 relief funds to finance the purchase of two paper mills in Wisconsin Rapids and Park Falls. Evers said guidelines may not have allowed for the federal money to be used for the loans to a timber industry group interested in the mills, but he said he hopes to find another solution to reopen the facilities. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you live near or worked in one of those paper mills. Do you think the state should be intervening to get them open? Do you see them as important parts of your region's economy? What questions do you have about this bill? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rob Mentzer is WPR's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Thanks.
You've been following these mills in Wisconsin Rapids and Park Falls for a while now. Can you give us a reminder of how they came to be in need of new ownership here?
Right. So the Verso Mill in Wisconsin Rapids, which is a 125-year-old mill there, went idle last summer and laid off 900 workers. So since that time, the prospects for and options for getting that mill back up and running has been of very high importance to like local leaders and political leaders and people in the region, because that is just a whole lot of jobs in central Wisconsin. The Park Falls mill is much smaller. But it's still accounted for about 180 jobs in that very small Northwoods community, and it had a different path where it had been in decline, and then it closed and reopened, and people were excited about a new ownership that was in September of 2020, and it just didn't work out. They have closed again earlier this year.
So now here's this new plan to bring both of them back into existence. Tell us a little bit about this this plan, who's doing it, and why they were looking for some help from the state.
Sure. So, I mean, this has to be understood as this is a complicated proposal, and it's far from a sure thing. But the idea here is that a group of timber professionals, loggers, have formed a cooperative, and they want to use this cooperative to purchase and operate these two paper mills. Now, obviously, the paper mills buy a lot of forest products, and so that it accounts for a lot of jobs in Wisconsin in the forest industry, particularly the Verso Mill in Wisconsin Rapids, which was so huge. It bought something like 25% of the timber that is cut in Wisconsin in a year. So their proposal, their idea is that as a cooperative, if they could run these paper mills, that there would be a market for their forest services, and that they, as a Wisconsin-based company, would have like a incentive to look at the long term and the health of these communities, rather than sort of the way we've seen hedge funds treat paper mills.
Now we have lawmakers passing this bill that says, hey, $65 million or so of loans to help this happen. Both parties, there's support from both parties there. Governor Evers says he likes the idea of providing these loans, but he vetoed this. What is the sticking point here, Rob?
Right. So the governor initially had proposed to pay for these loans out of federal incentive funds that would come from expanding Medicaid in Wisconsin. That is was not something that the Republican legislature was willing to do. Their bill that they passed would have paid for it through federal COVID relief dollars. And this is a debated matter, but there is at least a question of whether that is a legally allowable use of those COVID funds. So the governor vetoed that on the premise that there are other funding sources short of expanding Medicaid that now exist due to other vetoes that he made to the budget. His view is that the state has freed up enough revenue to put towards this. It remains to be seen whether he and Republican legislators will come to an agreement on that, but that is his theory right now.
So where it stands now is to bring this thing back online, a different bill with a different, I guess, funding mechanism would have to go through the legislature. The governor can't just, I don't know, move some numbers around on his end.
Well, so in theory, the governor could just declare that he changed his mind and this federal aid is allowable, and he has unilateral authority to allot it this way. But like, that's not really going to happen for a number of reasons, not least of which is because he seems to be the concern is at least real. So pretty much the paths forward would be a veto override, which some Republicans have said they're interested in trying, which may be a challenge. It's hard to get legislators to change their votes. Sort of starting over on negotiations for how to pay for this thing.
Is there any thought, Rob, that these things could be reopened by this group of timber professionals without something like this state loan?
Yes, there is. It's like hard. It's like very uncertain, right? Because, you know, the Verso needs to agree to sell this facility, or the Park Falls facility, which is in receivership, it would need to be approved there as well. So it's not like a sure thing, even if they have these loans, and it's not certainly sunk if they don't have the loans. There are other the cooperative has a number of other funding sources, private funding sources, other opportunities for loans. There are still ways that it can move forward, but I think everyone thinks that this chunk of state money is pretty important to make it move forward. And I think everyone is a little nervous about losing the opportunity if negotiations take too long.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us again.
All right. Thank you.
Rob Mentzer is WPR's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. He talked with us about the governor's veto of a bill that would have funded the purchase of two paper mills in Wisconsin Rapids and Park Falls. In just a minute, we'll talk to one of the authors of that bill, and you can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you live in central Wisconsin or by Park Falls near one of these mills, what do you think of this idea? How important is it to your community to see them reopen? More generally, do you think the state should get involved in providing things like loans or subsidies to help reopen businesses that may be the heart of the community that they work in? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now about a bill in the state legislature that would have helped finance the purchase of two closed paper mills, one in Park Falls, one in Wisconsin Rapids. Governor Evers vetoed that bill last week with questions over the funding source. One of the authors of the legislation joins us now. Scott Krug is a Republican representing the state's 72nd Assembly District that includes Wisconsin Rapids and Nakusa. Representative Krug, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. It's a pretty nice day outside today, so I'll stand outside and talk on the phone for a while. It's all good.
Great. I'm looking forward to getting outside myself, too. Well, before we get to the bill, can you talk about, especially the mill in your community, in your district there, how important is that as part of the jobs picture in your area?
I mean, it's heart and soul. I mean, this was number one employer up until June of last year. It's been the number one employer for close to a century. I mean, so this means just about everything to Wisconsin Rapids to get this facility up and going again. I mean, in its heyday, we had up to 6,000 people working in that mill throughout those heyday years. And at the time of the closure, fully operational, we were still at 1,000 jobs. So that's a pretty big impact to Wisconsin Rapids.
So can you talk about the bill that you and some of your colleagues put together? Tell us how it would have worked.
Yeah, so we came up with about a three-way split on the financing for the purchase from the Consolidated Cooperative, who had formed and was kind of an offshoot of our work with the Rapids Together Task Force. So we had gone back and forth for months and months to try to figure out a price tag on what this mill purchase may eventually be. So we kind of honed in on that number and said, okay, co-op, if you can raise a certain amount of money, prove that to the WEDC and to the BCPL, the Board of Commissioners of Public Land, we would be willing to help you get a pass-through loan from the Board of Commissioners of Public Land for up to $50 million, and then we would do a WEDC loan as well for another $50 million. So we were kind of thinking that price tag was kind of in that $130 to $150 million price range, and that this bill would take some of those federal Rescue Plan Act dollars and put it towards this purchase and revive both of these paper mills. It originally started with Rapids, and we added Park Falls in later as well.
Now, Governor Evers vetoed this, saying it's not clear that we can legally do this with that federal money. What's your reaction to the veto itself and that justification for it?
Well, you know, we were pretty surprised, kind of caught off guard about the veto, because, I mean, there's never going to be a situation where the federal government comes through and says precisely, if you have a paper mill in central Wisconsin that closed because of COVID, needs to reopen, you can use this money for that. I mean, it's not shown in any of the guidance or the frequently asked questions or the interim rules from ARPA or anything that you cannot use these dollars. So our plan was to utilize this money, knowing full well that the federal government has been using a lot of different projects and creativity to get these dollars into communities across the country. So I still don't know exactly where they're getting the indication that it can't be used, because nobody's shown us that still to this day.
You want to make this happen. Some of your Democratic colleagues in the legislature want to make this happen. Governor Evers seems to be open to the idea of providing a loan. He had wanted to fund it through expansion of federal Medicaid money, using some of the money saved from that to do it. Do you think that you can agree with the governor on somewhere for this money to come from?
I think so. I don't think this will be a straight GPR spend like he was asking us, but I know that there's other funding sources available. We're still really intent on, you know, fully implementing what the ARPA can do for our communities across the country. So I still think that's an option if we can get those final rules done, because right now Congress has put out this timeline for Treasury to have a rulemaking process, which they're about halfway through. The rulemaking process is still open, that anybody can weigh into Treasury as they're creating these rules to make it more specific, to make it usable in their mind, in the governor's mind. So we've actually put together a letter to ask our Congress representatives and the House and the Senate to weigh in with Treasury and help us, you know, clarify those rules just so there's no more confusion. On the backside of that, if for some reason Treasury came out and said absolutely no, then yes, we've got to figure out a way. So even as late as yesterday, after the veto happened, another company had announced its intent to purchase the entirety of Verso in a takeover bid. So now we've got this company, Atlas, who watched the veto happen, saw their opportunity and came in and said, fine, we'll just do this on our own. So now we've got competing interests and, you know, trying to see what lies ahead for the co-op if Atlas is going to be the one jumping in now.
Talking to Scott Krug, Republican from the state's 72nd Assembly District, Wisconsin Rapids area, looking at legislation he sponsored that would have provided a loan to help purchase a paper mill in Wisconsin Rapids, also one in Park Falls, vetoed by the governor over a dispute about where the money should come from. Representative Krug, there have been, I guess, philosophical arguments over the years saying the government shouldn't be leaning into the market in this way to pick an industry that we want to reopen, as sad as that may be for a community. What would you say to someone who objected on, I guess, those philosophical grounds?
Well, and that's kind of the other point we brought up to the governor's office, is that typically my caucus would be the ones raising that objection. So to get this bill through the legislature with bipartisan support was another selling point for us to say, hey, you know, governor, this is so important to people that they're kind of willing to set aside this previously held belief that we shouldn't be getting involved in this at all. And actually to get close to 67 votes in the state assembly was something that was pretty exciting. So that was the other thing that was a little confusing to us, is to have that widespread support, even from those who have that theory, made more sense to why this should have been signed into law.
Can you talk about why you like this idea of this cooperative, in effect, of timber professionals here in Wisconsin getting involved in this, as opposed to what I typically think more of that, you know, big conglomerate buys a slightly smaller conglomerate that happens to own that factory?
That's kind of where we're at right now, right? Is we always, this co-op has been the number one idea that has come up, and I think they're most important to the state of Wisconsin because we have a deep root with Wisconsin-based cooperative networks, whether it's credit unions or whether it's electrical co-ops. That model has shown to work in Wisconsin for so many things. And it was very unique to this industry for the first time ever to have this type of project come up where you've got Wisconsin-based individuals from logging and timber and all the side professions getting together to say, we want a place to take our product. We know this market. We know these mills. We know we can make this profitable. I think that's probably the best solution for long-term stability for Wisconsin Rapids and other paper mills, is to have this type of situation set up for us like these guys are ready to go.
So we've got the veto. We're back to the drawing board, in effect. What do you see as a timeline now as you try to, I guess, scramble to figure out how to come to an agreement between you all and the legislature and the governor?
That's the worst part about it, is that our legislative calendar doesn't allow us to take up new bills until the fall. I mean, we had a set calendar going in that said, you know, once state budget's done, the legislature comes back in September. So, I mean, I know we'll end up with a bill at some point in September. If we get to that point, if Verso doesn't sell to somebody else before then, I know we'll have a bill, but it just delays us by a few months. And that's the most frustrating part about the veto, is that a ready-made solution was presented from homegrown individuals in our state that just didn't get across the finish line because of a signature. So, I mean, it's tough. I mean, you know, we've got to wait a few months now.
I know communications have not always flowed freely between Republicans in the legislature and the Democratic governor, apart from pointing fingers either way. I mean, are your people talking to his people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even as the day we voted on the bill, we were in communications with his staff to try to figure out if we could make some amendments work. And, you know, the governor and I had spoke with Senator Teston 3 times throughout the last year. And, you know, the governor pledged to us, you know, whatever you guys come up with, I'll support. So we didn't really think we had to worry much about the governor's office. I mean, I give him credit. He's been engaged. He's had WDC engaged and part of our task force. We've at DWD with us, making sure that we could make sure unemployment benefits were not delayed because of the bottlenecks we were having last year. And I think, everything had run smoothly up until that last day. And I think we had a really good model moving forward for legislative actions. We had a lot of folks coming out of their silos working together until the veto happened.
Representative Krug, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Anytime. Take care.
That's Scott Krug, Republican from Wisconsin's 72nd Assembly District. He joined us to talk about a bill he co-authored that would have helped fund the purchase of two paper mills in central Wisconsin. The bill got a veto from Governor Evers last week. Evers says he's open to other sources of funding for the loans to the Timber Professionals Association.